There was an article in the Wichita Eagle 10 days ago about the 946 billionaires in the world today. Six of them live in Kansas. A couple of them live here in Wichita, or Wichita is at least their home. Any idea how much $1 billion is? If you stretched dollar bills out end to end, 1 million of them would reach almost Emporia. But 1 billion of them would go around the world 4 times. And a couple of those guys, Gates and Buffett, have enough to go around the world 200 times. That's a lot of money. That's serious money, except when the government is spending it. Then it's just chicken feed, it seems like. Today we're going to talk about treasure. And not just the billionaire kind. The kind all of us have. We all have some treasure. I'm kind of glad there's no ulterior motive for preaching on this topic today. We don't have any special project we're trying to raise money for. The general fund is in pretty good shape. And we're out of debt. We're talking about money today because Jesus talked about it. We're working our way through the Sermon on the Mount. I suppose some of us are pretty wounded by now because we've been convicted on a number of issues as we've been studying. But this morning we come to Matthew chapter 6, verse 19. And I want to read just a couple of verses here as we note that Jesus shatters several common misconceptions that Christians have about treasure. Matthew 6, 19 and 20. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. The first misconception has to do with what we should do with treasure. And Jesus' answer is, store it up. Hoard it. Does that surprise you? Laying up treasure is God's plan for His children. It's a commandment He gives to us. In order to fulfill that commandment, we must be obedient. Please note that Jesus is talking about actual treasure. Money and prized possessions. He's not just speaking figuratively to communicate that we should pursue things that are spiritual more than things that are secular. After all, he uses the same term to describe treasures on earth that he uses to describe treasures in heaven. And the term for stored up conveys the notion of stockpiling or hoarding. The original Greek carries the connotation of stacking or laying out horizontally as you would with a row of coins. Jesus urges us to stockpile treasure. The second misconception that Jesus shatters has to do with whom we should store it up for. It's for ourselves. He's saying we should act in our own self-interest. And that's not the same as saying we should act selfishly. There's a big difference between self-interest and selfishness. Selfishness is when we pursue gain at the expense of others. But when we stockpile treasure in the right place, we're not taking anything away from anybody else because God has enough treasure to go around and then some. So we can act in our own enlightened self-interest and still bring glory to God. As a matter of fact, that which glorifies God is that which is best for us. So we should be in the business of stockpiling treasure and doing it for ourselves. The third thing Jesus tells us is where we should store it up. And he says we should store it up in heaven. Whenever you talk to a real estate agent, he almost always tells you that there are only three things that matter when you buy real estate or a house. And that is location, location, and location. You've heard it many times. Well, location also matters when it comes to where we're going to store up treasure. Storing it up on earth is stupid. Storing it up in heaven is wise. First, storing up treasures on earth is stupid. Why? Because of what happens to it here on earth. If it's cloth, like fancy clothes or oriental rugs, the moths are going to get to it, or mold and mildew. If it's metal, it is subject to rust and corrosion. As a matter of fact, deterioration, decay, and destruction is the end of virtually every human treasure. Now, it's true. There are some treasures that have lasted thousands of years, like the treasures that came out of King Tut's tomb. But what are a few thousand years in respect to all of eternity? And most human treasures don't even last a century. Our text goes on to indicate that even valuables that are not susceptible to moths or rust can still be stolen by thieves. Even Tut's tomb was not found intact. Experts believe it was robbed twice in ancient times and then resealed, with perhaps 60% of the metalwork stolen by those thieves. Tut's tomb was a very small tomb because he was a very insignificant pharaoh. There were only four small rooms at the end of a long tunnel. In contrast, King Ramses II had 132 rooms in his tomb, but all the treasures in his tomb were stolen. Still, the treasures in Tut's little tomb are just mind-boggling when you go to the museum in Cairo. There are other ways, of course, that earthly treasure can be lost besides being eaten by moths or rusted or stolen. Bad investments have ruined many people's treasures. Galloping inflation has stolen the treasures of many people, particularly in the 70s and early 80s. The fact is, earthly treasure is always temporary. Proverbs 23:5 says, "Cast but a glance at riches, and they are gone, for they will surely sprout wings and fly off to the sky like an eagle." The next time you go out and buy a new car, just imagine in your mind it's sprouting wings and flying off, never to be seen again. It will happen in 6, 8, 10 years. If you're really fortunate, it might last 12 or 15, and then it's gone. The psalmist's advice makes a lot of sense to us when he says, "Do not be overawed when a man grows rich." You tend to be overawed. I do. Sometimes I tune in to a channel that's talking about the great yachts in the world today, some of which cost $300 million for a boat. Or you see the mansions in the United States that cost over $50 million, and you sit there with your mouth hanging open at the riches that are being displayed. The psalmist says, don't do that. Don't be overawed when a man grows rich, when the splendor of his house increases, for he will take nothing with him when he dies. His splendor will not descend with him into the grave, and it won't go up with him if he happens to be a believer. The riches will all be left. Friends, when Jesus tells us not to store up treasure here on earth, it's not just because the wealth might be lost someday. It's because it will be lost someday. Either it leaves us while we live, or we leave it when we die. There are no exceptions. Please understand that Jesus is not condemning wealth here, but the hoarding of wealth in a particular place, namely on earth. He is not prohibiting things, but prohibiting the love of things here on earth. He is cautioning us against making stuff our treasure and storing it up here on earth as though it had ultimate value. It's just plain stupid to do that. But fortunately, there is another location where you can hoard your wealth, and that is in heaven, and that is wise. Why? Well, for one thing, there aren't any moths there. There is no rust in heaven. Inflation doesn't trouble heaven. Investments there are safe and secure. But if you're thinking with me at all yet, you're probably thinking this, okay, storing up treasure on earth is stupid. Storing up treasure in heaven is wise. How do I get it from here to there? Good question. I'm glad you asked. Randy Alcorn has written a wonderful little booklet entitled The Treasure Principle. I stole his title this morning. And I borrowed some of his biblical insights. The treasure principle is this. You can't take it with you, but you can send it on ahead. The truth of this principle is taught in a number of passages in the New Testament. And we're going to look at some of those passages. But first, I want to offer you some corollaries to the treasure principle. We might call these presuppositions, pre-understandings, things we must grasp if the treasure principle is going to be internalized, okay? So, corollary number one, God owns everything. We're just His money managers. This is basic, friends. If we accept the popular dichotomy between the spiritual and the secular, believing that God is only concerned about our spiritual lives, He's not concerned about our business lives, our financial lives, our leisure, our politics. We will never discover what the treasure principle is all about. God is sovereign over all of life. He is the rightful owner of everything we own and everything that is. The psalmist tells us that He owns the cattle on 1,000 hills, the wealth in every mine. The animals of the forest belong to Him. There are many verses that tell us clearly that it all belongs to God. This truth can have some powerful implications for our lives. The story is told that a distraught man rode his horse up to John Wesley and shouted, "Mr. Wesley, something terrible has happened. Your house has burned to the ground." Wesley weighed the news and then calmly replied, "No, the Lord's house burned to the ground. That means one less responsibility for me." He understood that it all belongs to God. Corollary two, God has the right to determine how His possessions are used. Now the logic is airtight. If it all belongs to Him, then He has the right to determine how we use it. Now, God has given us what I would call delegated authority to manage His money. And He actually gives us a fair degree of self-determination in doing that. The well-known parable of the talents in Matthew 25 reveals this. The owner there gave a number of different servants an amount of money to invest. He didn't tell them how to invest it, but he did hold them accountable for their faithfulness in investing it wisely. While God actually lays down very few rules for us in our use of money, He does give us a lot of principles. And if we'll follow those principles, we will enjoy His wisdom and we will know what His will is. Corollary three, our hearts always go where we put God's money. This comes directly out of our scripture text today, verse 21 of Matthew 6. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Now the truth of this should be obvious. Have you ever made a large stock purchase and then forgotten that you owned it? No. No Nobody does that. If you're going to buy 1,000 or more shares of a stock, you're going to check the stock price every day. Or maybe even have a program on your computer where you can check it several times a day. You're going to be concerned about that stock. If you buy a new luxury car, you're going to keep it clean, you're going to service it regularly, and you're going to make sure that you don't park it where somebody's going to ding it. I was at a parking lot just yesterday. Someone had driven in a Mercedes coupe, probably an $80,000 to $100,000 car. I don't know, I haven't priced them recently. And they had driven in and taken up 2 parking spaces, put their car right in the middle. Made me want to go and key the car, you know. Right? That was my sin nature acting, and I didn't do it. But that person's heart is in that car. Now, if you drive an old car of 150,000 miles, you don't care where you park it. It doesn't matter. You're not concerned about it. Money leads, friends, and hearts follow. I've heard people say, I've really heard this a number of times, I wish I had more of a heart for missions. Well, Jesus tells you exactly how to solve that. Exactly. Just give money to missions. And your heart will follow your money. You wish you cared more about eternal things than you do? Move some of your money from temporal things to eternal things, and you will have a greater heart for eternal things. Corollary number 4. Materialism is self-destructive. Here's a fascinating passage in the book of Ecclesiastes. I want to encourage you to turn to it. I'll put it up on the screen, but there's a reason why I want you to turn to it. It's Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verses 10 through 15. And in this passage, the author focuses primarily on the spirit of materialism that results from the love of money. Listen to these words. Whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never, never satisfied with his income. Bill Gates is not satisfied with $46 or $57 billion. He's got 57. Buffett has 46. This too is meaningless, he writes. As goods increase, so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owner except to feast his eyes on them? The sleep of a laborer is sweet, whether he eats little or much. But the abundance of a rich man permits him no sleep. I have seen a grievous evil under the sun, wealth hoarded to the harm of its owner, or wealth lost through some misfortune, so that when he has a son, there's nothing left for him. Naked a man comes from his mother's womb, and as he comes, so he departs. He takes nothing from his labor that he can carry in his hand. Now, Randy Alcorn has done a good job of summarizing 8 results from materialism that come right out of this text. And as you look at these results, I've put the verse there so you can check the verse and see that it really says that. The more you have, the more you want. The more you have, the less you're satisfied. The more you have, the more people will come after it, including the government. The more you have, the more you realize it's of little benefit except to look at. The more you have, the more you have to worry about. The more you have, the more you can hurt yourself by holding on to it. The more you have, the more you have to lose. And the more you have, the more you'll leave behind, because you'll leave it all behind. Now, isn't it amazing, in view of these truths, these aren't just suggestions here, these are facts. In view of these facts, isn't it amazing how many people are obsessed by materialism? In fact, isn't it even more amazing how many professing Christians are obsessed by materialism? The evil one has sold us a bill of goods, friends. Corollary 5. When God prospers me, it is not only to raise my standard of living, but also my standard of giving. You know, I don't really have a problem with Christians improving their standard of living to a point. Moving to a larger house or buying a newer car is not automatically sinful. But we must not lose sight of the fact that God's rich blessings lay a responsibility on us. God comes right out and tells us exactly why He gives us more than we need. It's not so that we can find new clever ways of spending it. It's not so that we can indulge ourselves and spoil our children. It's not so we can become financially independent, particularly independent of Him. He tells us exactly why He gives us more than we need in 2 Corinthians chapter 9. Here's what He says. This is Paul speaking. For He who supplies seed to the sower, that's God, and bread for food, will also supply and increase your store of seed and will enlarge the harvest of your righteousness. You will be made rich in every way so that... What does so that mean? He's giving you the reason why God has made you rich. So that you can be generous on every occasion. And through us, your generosity will result in thanksgiving to God. It's so that we can be generous and God will receive thanks. I wonder how many of us have ever stopped to think that if we are not rich, comparatively speaking, we're all really rich, but if we're not rich, comparatively speaking, if the reason for that may be that God knows that we would not be generous if we were rich, but we would be selfish. I don't think that's always true. The widow who gave 2 mites was very poor. Jesus commended her for her generosity. Had she been rich, I'm sure she would have been even more generous. But sometimes I think God doesn't give us more wealth because He can't trust us with it. Of course, God grants us resources not only so that we can be generous, but also simply because He loves us. He knows that money managers have to have something to live on. They have legitimate needs. He doesn't demand that His money managers live in poverty. He doesn't resent them making reasonable expenditures for themselves. I happen to believe that God delights in giving things to His children and watching them enjoy them. But, let's use our imaginations for a moment. Suppose that you are the executive manager of a privately held company. You're the CEO. And the owner has been very generous with you, giving you a great salary, lots of perks and benefits. But he discovers that you have used company funds to build yourself a mansion. And you have bought several extremely expensive sports cars. And he checked your expense account. And he sees that all the flights you have made, personal and company flights, have been on first class. And you've been staying in $1,000 a night hotel rooms. And you've been eating all your meals at Ruth's Chris Steakhouse and other similar joints. Don't you think the owner would be a little upset? Don't you think he would call you to be accountable for squandering his funds? And especially don't you think that would be true if the owner's son had not lived high on the hog when he was there working at the company? Think about it. Now, having examined these corollaries to the treasure principle, I want us to return to the treasure principle. You can't take it with you, but you can send it on ahead. Jesus teaches this clearly in several passages. There's a parallel passage to the Sermon on the Mount in Luke 12:33, for example, where Jesus says, "Sell your possessions and give to the poor." I don't think he means all your possessions, but he says, sell some of them and give to the poor. "Provide purses for yourselves that will not wear out, a treasure in heaven that will not be exhausted, where no thief comes near and no moth destroys." Well, apparently one way that we can send it on ahead is to give to the poor. And that becomes treasure in heaven. In another place, Jesus is speaking to a rich young ruler. And he says, "If you want to be perfect, go, sell your possessions and give it to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come follow me." Money given to the poor by a true disciple of Jesus becomes treasure in heaven. And not only becomes treasure in heaven, but it appreciates at an astonishing rate. 10,000%, he says, and then a few verses later, verse 29. Paul says something similar to all this in 1 Timothy chapter 6. He urges Timothy to command his parishioners as a young pastor to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. Now listen to this. "In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves." You heard that phrase anywhere else? Right out of the Sermon on the Mount. "They will lay treasure up for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age so that they can take hold of the life that is truly life." It appears from this that we can stockpile treasure in heaven, not only by giving to the poor, but also by doing good deeds and just living a life of sharing. But the passage that teaches the treasure principle most clearly is Luke chapter 16. This passage tells you how to move your treasures from earth to heaven. It's a passage that I preached on 2.5 years ago. I'm just going to give you a brief review of that message this morning. In Matthew 6, Jesus tells us to make the transfer. Here he tells us how. Listen to these words. Jesus told his disciples, "There was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, 'What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be manager any longer.' The manager said to himself, 'What shall I do now? My master is taking my job away. I'm not strong enough to dig and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do. That when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses.' So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' 800 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, 'Take your bill, sit down quickly and make it 400. Then he asked the second, 'And how much do you owe?' 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. He told him, 'Take your bill and make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly gain to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings.'" This parable is typically known as the parable of the dishonest steward, or of the shrewd manager. It depicts the first century commodities manager, accused of fraud and terminated by his boss. He hates to even think of taking a lower paying job. He's too lazy to work manually, so he devises a plan. And the plan is to cheat his owner by lowering the debts of the debtors and making friends of those people in the process. When asked why he was doing this, I am sure he replied, "Who knows? I may need a friend. Don't forget that I helped you out." It was a very clever thing to do. True, it was extremely dishonest, but it was also smart. He uses his head to make a couple of warm friends before he goes out into the hard, cold world of unemployment. Now the parable ends in verse 8 there, and it's at this point that Jesus applies its moral lessons for us, and I'm very glad he does that. I would struggle with this parable if it weren't that Jesus tells us what it means. He gives us two moral lessons, and the first is Christians should be shrewd as well as good. Jesus states this principle negatively in verse 8 as he laments the fact that the people of this world are smarter than the people of the light. There is no hint here, I think, that Jesus is commending the manager's dishonesty. It's taken for granted that Jesus' followers will be honest, but they should also be smart. The manager was smart. He was shrewd. He was clever in the way he used money to prepare for the future. And we should be the same. It's as though Jesus were putting a want ad in the paper saying, "Wanted, good people with this bad man's business sense." Every Christian is ultimately going to end up where this manager found himself. We too are facing the certain end of our material resources. Within a few years at most, each one of us is going to stand before God with no wealth, no titles, no influence, no money. All that will be left behind. We brought nothing into this world and we can take nothing out of it. Or can we? There is something we can take with us, or at least send them on ahead, and that is friends. Jesus tells us here that Christians should use their possessions to make friends. Here's how he puts it in verse 9 again. "I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourself, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings." Now, he speaks of worldly wealth here. That's a word that you know, sometimes translated mammon, or the mammon of unrighteousness. Why is it called worldly and why is it called unrighteous? It's because of the way it's used. Money is used to buy and sell drugs, buy and sell bodies. It's used for gambling. It's used for stealing, cheating, tax fraud. You take a $20 bill out of your pocket, just think how many wicked ways that $20 bill may have been used in the last year. Jesus says you can redeem that $20 bill. You can redeem it by using it to buy a friend, to make a friend. I want to suggest to you that the kind of friends he's talking about are very clear here. They're the friends that will welcome us when we get to heaven. So they are friends we have made for God. They are people we have invested in so that they have become believers and will either welcome us when we get there or we'll welcome them because we got there first. I want to suggest to you that this could be a major paradigm shift when it comes to our thinking about biblical generosity. In order to make friends for God, it's not enough just to pray for the lost. We should also pay for the lost. Now, I'm not talking about buying a funeral service, as some religions do, so you can try to help your lost loved one. get out of purgatory. I'm talking about paying for them while they're alive and making friends with God for them, using your money to accomplish that. Here's a principle to think about. Heaven should be populated with people who will welcome us when we arrive because we invested in their salvation. Or if we get there first, we can welcome them. Now this investing I'm talking about can be done either indirectly or directly. Whenever you give money to a Bible-believing evangelistic church, you are in effect making friends for God with your money. As that church has outreach and programs, you may not know who you're reaching, but you are helping to make friends for God. If you prefer not to make direct investments, you can get involved in a mutual fund. You can give to the missions program of the church. And then every missionary that's out on every field, you're investing in, and therefore investing in the lives of the friends they're making for God. You can give to a mutual fund called Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. And when you give money to Trinity, you are making friends for God through every graduate of that school that is pastoring a local church or preaching on some foreign mission field or teaching in some Bible college or seminary. But there are direct ways that you can do this as well. We had 13 people leave the church this morning at 4 a.m. and leave the church. They left the parking lot to go to New Orleans to make friends for God. And there's another group that left and went to southern Mexico this weekend to make friends for God. They may not see the fruit of their labor while they're there, but Ed Ollie will harvest that fruit after they leave. Think for a moment how a salesman makes friends. He studies his product, he studies his clients, and then he spends money on his clients. He takes them to fancy restaurants because he wants to make a friend for his business. Why shouldn't we do the same thing with God's money? Businessmen, do you ever think about taking a business colleague out to a nice restaurant to share your faith with him as well as to sell him a product or instead of selling him a product? If you have extra tickets to WSU games, do you always take a friend who's already a friend of God? Or do you think about taking someone who's not yet a friend of God and could become a friend of God as you invest in that individual? The treasure principle tells us that we can't take it with us, but we can send it on ahead. I want to close this morning with a couple of simple questions. What treasure has God given you? And what does He want you to do with it? Bruce Wilkinson writes, "The people I've met who are most faithful with their money are also the most free of its entanglements. They are the ones I admire most because they understand that if you don't serve God with your money, you will serve your money." And you know, that's really what Jesus says as He wraps up this whole section of Matthew 6. He says, "No one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. It can't be done." When we serve God, we are using God's money to accomplish God's desires. When we serve money, we are using God's money to accomplish our own desires. And when we do that, we inevitably follow an investment policy that invests that money here on earth where it is not going to last. That is not a wise investment strategy, especially for people who have inside knowledge that the markets are going to collapse totally. And every currency on the face of the earth is going to be worthless. We know that. It's going to happen when Jesus comes. Now Jesus is the foremost market timer there is. His financial forecast for the earth is very bleak. But he's unreservedly bullish about heaven. He wants us to invest our hoarded money there. Let's pray.